From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
I spent 1 year ago, approximately 1 year ago, I was on death row in the cell. And now I plan on running for state representative for the 6th District of Illinois.
A man who spent 17 years on death row for a crime he did not commit is running for the Illinois State House. We're joined by Aaron Patterson, live in our studio. One of four men pardoned this past January by Illinois Governor George Ryan's clearing of death row in his final days in office. Secretary of State Donald Rumsfeld denies Saddam Hussein POW status, and George Bush calls for him to get the ultimate penalty. We'll talk to Professor of International Law, Francis Boyle.
When you add up Bush and Ashcroft assault on the United States Constitution and basic principles of international law, remember, the United States is not immune to the laws of history. The Romans lost their republic, the Athenians lost their democracy, and we here in the United States could very easily lose our republic as well. That's what's at stake here.
And presidential envoy James Baker wins agreement from Germany and France to forgive billions of dollars in debt to Iraq. We'll take a look at the former Secretary of State's trip around Europe to relieve Iraqi debt, Halliburton reconstruction, and more.
So the real problem is that we had a Frankenstein monster that got out of control, a Bush administration between 1988 and Operation Desert Storm in 1990-91 that essentially turned a blind eye to this continuing shipment to Iraq.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. During a rare interview, President Bush Tuesday night called for the execution of Saddam Hussein, saying he should face, quote, the ultimate penalty. But he said Hussein's fate should be left to the Iraqi people. Meanwhile, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld announced the CIA is now heading up the interrogation of Saddam Hussein, although the captured leader remains in military custody. Fighting between U.S. troops and members of the Iraqi resistance continued west of Baghdad. Tuesday, U.S. troops said they killed 11 Iraqis who were planning an ambush. Meanwhile, in Baghdad, at least 10 people died today and 15 were injured after a fuel tanker exploded. Police said the tanker collided with a bus, setting off a bomb that was meant for a nearby police station. On Monday, at least two Iraqi police stations came under attack, leaving nine dead. Meanwhile, in Samarra, U.S. forces raided the city, arresting 80 Iraqis over the past 2 days. Agence France-Presse reports U.S. troops stormed into houses in the middle of the night and blew up doors and gates with explosives to gain access to locked homes. Pro-Saddam rallies were reportedly held in Fallujah, Ramadi, and Mosul. At the Vatican, a senior cardinal strongly criticized the U.S. for releasing video footage of Saddam Hussein, where the captured man was handled, quote, like a cow. The cardinal, Renato Martino, said, quote, I feel pity to see this man destroyed. Seeing him like this, a man in his tragedy, despite all the heavy blame he bears, I had a sense of compassion for him. The cardinal also reiterated the Vatican's opposition to the death penalty. In South Korea, the government announced today that it would send 3,000 troops to Iraq in support of the occupation. And France and Germany have issued a joint statement with the United States calling for a substantial reduction of Iraq's staggering $120 billion debt next year. The Washington Post reports Homeland Security officials want to expand the FBI's criminal databases to include the names of 140,000 undocumented immigrants and foreign students. The database, known as the National Crime Information Center, includes the names of more than 40 million felons, fugitives, missing persons. It is used by more than 80,000 law enforcement agencies. The U.S. Tuesday predicted that the U.S. will become more dependent on foreign oil supplies over the next 20 years. Currently, about 54% of the oil used in the U.S. comes from foreign sources. The government is now predicting foreign oil will account for 70% of the oil used in the U.S. by 2025. Attorney General John Ashcroft and his 2000 Senate campaign have agreed to pay a $37,000 fine for campaign finance violations. The Federal Elections Commission determined that Ashcroft's campaign had illegally received about $110,000 in excessive donations from political action committees. As part of the settlement, Ashcroft denied any wrongdoing. Two advisory panels of the Food and Drug Administration have voted to recommend that the contraceptive known as the morning after pill be sold over the counter. Planned Parenthood estimates the pill could prevent as many as half of the 3 million annual unintended pregnancies in this country. In an interview with ABC, President Bush said he backs a constitutional amendment that would bar same-sex marriage. He said, quote, "I would support a constitutional amendment which would honor marriage between a man and a woman." The Bush administration has abandoned its plans to rewrite the Clean Water Act and remove protection from millions of acres of wetlands. The decision comes after the Environmental Protection Agency received more than 133,000 comments opposing the proposed plan. In Washington, negotiations over a Central American free trade agreement have come a step closer to collapse after Costa Rica walked away from talks with the United States. This, according to the Financial Times. Costa Rica is one of five Central American nations involved in the negotiations with the United States. The others are El Salvador, Honduras, Guatemala, and Nicaragua.
They say everything can be replaced. They say every distance is not near. So I remember every face of every man who put me here. I see my life come shining from the west down to the east. Any day now, I shall be released.
You are listening to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Well, during a rare interview on Tuesday night, President Bush called for the execution of Saddam Hussein, saying he should face, quote, the ultimate penalty. But he said Hussein's fate should be left to the Iraqi people. Meanwhile, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld announced the CIA is now heading up the interrogation of Saddam Hussein, although the captured leader remains in military custody. Donald Rumsfeld also said that Saddam Hussein was not being granted prisoner of war status. Late yesterday, we reached Francis Boyle on the telephone. Francis Boyle is an expert in international law. He is a professor of international law at the University of Illinois. We asked him to talk about the implications of the denial of POW status, as well as President Bush calling for the death penalty.
Clearly, Saddam Hussein is the president and commander-in-chief of the armed forces in Iraq, and he is a prisoner of war under the Third Geneva Convention of 1949. We have been through all this before with Manuel Noriega, when Bush Sr. invaded Panama and apprehended Noriega, they originally claimed that he was not entitled to be treated as a prisoner of war. Eventually, Judge Hoover down in Florida ruled that, in fact, he was entitled to be treated as a prisoner of war within the meaning of the Third Geneva Convention. The trial went on anyway. He was convicted. But still today, as we speak, Manuel Noriega has all the benefits of the Third Geneva Convention. So even the International Committee of the Red Cross has just publicly stated that Saddam Hussein is entitled to be treated as a prisoner of war. So far, it appears to me the public parading of his medical exam on television violates Article 13 and Article 14 of the Third Geneva Convention. Article 13 says, quote, prisoners of war must at all times be humanely treated. In particular, no prisoner of war may be subjected to physical mutilation or medical or scientific experiments of any kind, et cetera, et cetera. Prisoners of war must at all times be protected, particularly against acts of violence or intimidation and against insults and public curiosity. Article 14, prisoners of war are entitled in all circumstances to respect for their persons and their honor. Certainly, when this type of treatment, public humiliation, was inflicted on United States Armed Forces by Iraq, we correctly took the position that this was a war crime and that we would prosecute the people who were responsible for it. What is sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander. The same principle of law applies here. If they had just shown the mugshot where his beard had been shaved and he looked like the Saddam Hussein we all know, I don't believe that would have qualified as a violation of Article 13 and Article 14. But clearly the video of the medical exam was designed to humiliate the man in the eyes of the entire world. Despite what Rumsfeld said, there is no basis whatsoever to disqualify him as a prisoner of war. In the event that he is prosecuted for war crimes, he maintains his status as a prisoner of war throughout the prosecution. Again, that principle was well established even here in the United States in federal district court with respect to Manuel Noriega, pursuant to the rulings by Judge Hoover down in Florida, and those rulings were correct. So this implication by Rumsfeld that somehow, for some reason, we might deprive him of his POW status would, if acted upon, constitute a grave breach of the Third Geneva Convention. I don't see how he's going to get a fair trial in Iraq at all. Under the laws of war, the so-called Coalition Provisional Authority set up by Bremer is nothing more than a puppet government in accordance with U.S. Army Field Manual 2710 of 1956, the Laws of Land Warfare. The laws of war do not prohibit setting up a puppet government if that's what we want to do. However, it still remains a puppet government, and we are fully responsible for whatever the puppet government does. Here, the puppet government has set up an ad hoc war crimes tribunal that was drafted by the president. By the Pentagon. The problem with that is that the Hague regulations and U.S. Army Field Manual 27-10 make it quite clear that the belligerent occupant, namely the United States government, cannot alter the domestic legal regime or the municipal courts or constitution of an occupied state. They remain intact pending the occupation. So these are going to be nothing more than puppet kangaroo courts. The fix is already in. Bush already said today, I guess in his interview on ABC News, that Saddam Hussein should be executed. It's on the wire services today that one of the members of this puppet government has already said the day we get our so-called sovereignty, we'll put him on trial and we'll execute him the next day. So this is a joke and a fraud. It's going to be pretty much like the kangaroo court operation down in Guantanamo. And there's a very good reason, of course, why the Bush people want to do this and not transfer him to some type of international tribunal, because if they transfer him to an international tribunal for prosecution, then, of course, he would be able to bring out in his defense the complicity and aiding and abetting by the United States government going back to the so-called liberal Carter administration and Zbigniew Brzezinski, who engineered the so-called tilt toward Iraq and running up through Reagan and Bush Sr. for his crimes against Iran, the Iran-Iraq war, and everything else, providing biological weapons, chemical weapons, components for nuclear weapons. So it seems to me they're certainly not going to want some type of free, fair trial that clearly would be required by the Third Geneva Convention to prosecute him. They want a show trial where the fix is in, which it already is in. They're going to control who the lawyers are, who the judges are, what the evidence is, what the news media is. Again, pretty much like what we're seeing down in Guantanamo today with the kangaroo courts, only instead of doing it by themselves, they'll use the puppet government set up by Paul Bremer and his proxies.
What about the three Iraqi Governing Council members who were brought in to question him, including the CIA-backed Ahmed Chalabi? How does that fit into international law?
Well, under the Third Geneva Convention, you cannot really interrogate a prisoner of war. You can ask him questions. But interrogation, that is actually giving him the third degree to get answers, coercing him, putting bag on his head, depriving him of food or water, toilet facilities, things of that nature, is prohibited. And indeed, it's very interesting that this fall, just recently, the delegate of the International Committee of the Red Cross, who had just been in Guantanamo, made an extraordinary, almost unprecedented statement with respect to Guantanamo and actually used the word interrogation, that interrogations were going on there. And an interrogation, you know, along the lines of the third degree is clearly prohibited. I just heard on the radio he has been now transferred to the custody of the CIA. Well, one thing we know about the CIA is they could not care less about the Third Geneva Convention. So this is a very serious matter. Indeed, usually when there is a dirty job to be done that the military knows will violate the Geneva Conventions, they turn it over to the CIA and let the CIA do it. For example, when that predator drone assassinated the person, I guess, over in Yemen, the Pentagon wanted nothing to do with it. They knew it was an assassination. They knew it was illegal. So they let the CIA do it. So this is a very ominous sign that he's being turned over to the CIA. The Pentagon knows full well they are accountable under the Geneva Conventions, whereas the CIA couldn't care less.
What about the argument that Saddam Hussein was not elected, he's a dictator, he's a murderer, he killed thousands of Iraqis, imprisoned them, had them tortured? Why does he deserve anything?
Well, the Third Geneva Convention gives him a trial and affords him all the protections of the Third Geneva Convention. The United States government did draft that convention in the aftermath of the Nazi horrors in World War II. Look, President Roosevelt gave Goering a trial at Nuremberg. Both Stalin and Churchill felt that the top Nazi leaders should simply be taken out and shot. And President Roosevelt took the position, well, that would make us no different from them, and they had to have a trial. And so it was President Roosevelt's idea that there should be a trial of the major Nazi war criminals that later culminated in Nuremberg. But look, Saddam Hussein is small potatoes compared to someone like Goering or Ribbentrop or any of these other Nazi war criminals. Certainly, if they deserved a trial, a fair trial, Saddam Hussein deserves a trial. Milosevic is getting a trial there at the ICTY. He's not facing the death penalty. Obviously, there's been criticisms, as they always are, but as the trial has evolved, I think, you know, most people looking at it saying, well, he's getting his day in court as best as possible under these circumstances. So I don't see why Saddam Hussein should be treated any differently. I think, you know, we should adhere to the spirit of President Roosevelt when it came to the Nazi war criminals. We really have to ask ourselves who we are and what we're about. What we saw here with his mistreatment is pretty much what the Roman emperors used to do to the defeated barbarian kings. They would haul them into the streets of Rome and parade them through so that all the assembled masses could chant in unison, "Hail Caesar." Well, that's pretty much, I think, what we're doing today with respect to this man, but using 21st century technology, and now it's Hail Bush. Is that the way the American Republic is going? The same way the Roman Republic went with the coup d'etat launched by Julius Caesar on December 7th, 43 BC. I think we all need to consider this very seriously. When you add up the Bush and Ashcroft assault on the United States Constitution and basic principles of international law. Remember, the United States is not immune to the laws of history. The Romans lost their republic, the Athenians lost their democracy, and we here in the United States could very easily lose our republic as well. That's what's at stake here.
Francis Boyle, professor of international law at the University of Illinois. You are listening to Democracy Now! Next up, we talk to a German reporter about Iraq, about James Baker, and about France and Germany saying that they will forgive some of the Iraqi debt. Stay with us. Money by Pink Floyd here on Democracy Now! The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Presidential envoy James Baker won agreement yesterday from Germany and France to forgive billions of dollars in debt to Iraq. The agreement came after meeting with German Chancellor Gerhard Schroeder, where Baker overcame what is described as serious German misgivings about the exclusion of German firms from Iraqi reconstruction. A day earlier, France announced it would forgive about $3 billion in debt. According to a senior Bush administration official, the three nations have agreed that having a new government in place is not a precondition for moving forward on debt forgiveness. The former Secretary of State will continue on his five-day trip with stops in Rome, Moscow, and London. This marks Baker's first official trip since he joined the Bush administration 2 weeks ago. Baker remains a senior partner in the law firm of Baker Botts, which is deeply involved in the fight for oil and gas in the Caspian Sea. Baker Botts includes Halliburton among its list of clients, as well as the Saudi government, against a lawsuit filed by family members of who lost relatives in 9/11. James Baker is also a senior counselor to the powerful investment firm Carlyle Group. We go now to Andreas Zumach, who is the UN correspondent with the German newspaper Die Tageszeitung. Last year, Zumach obtained the unedited copy of Iraq's 12,000-page report to the United Nations, including portions on how Iraq acquired its weapon capability from Germany, the United States, and other countries. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Yeah, thank you, Amy. This was actually just a year ago to the day when we published it, and I think that was the last time the two of us talked together.
That's right, and that was the 12,000-page report Iraq had given to the UN, and if you can just remind listeners what happened to that report before the majority of the Security Council got it.
Well, the U.S. stole it after its arrival in New York. They took it down to Washington under the pretension that only in Washington you had decent copy machines to make copies for the other members of the council. But what came back to New York a few days later was only a 3,000-page version. And this is all what the 10 non-permanent members of the council ever got. Only the five permanent members, U.S., Russia, Great Britain, France, and China, till today have the 12,000 pages. And in the short version, the 3,000 pages, you have no mentioning of all the far-reaching complicity the U.S., Germany, France, Britain, Soviet Union, and to a lesser degree, China, are guilty of during the last 30 years, complicity with the regime of Saddam Hussein, a point Francis Boyle already pointed out.
Well, can we start by talking about James Baker's trip to Germany?
Yes.
How did it go? What did he say?
I was a little bit surprised when you just quoted the U.S. Government spokesman and his characterization, or maybe Baker's own characterization, of his talks with German Chancellor Gerhard Schröder, when he said that, quote, he overcame serious problems regarding the fact that so far the Bush administration is still only giving lucrative reconstruction orders to German companies. As far as the way it's being portrayed here in Germany by the spokesman of Schröder, it sounds somewhat different. He said this issue is still unresolved, and we do expect the Bush administration to change the position. And secondly, there is only a basic declaration of intention on the side of the German government to come to, let me quote, some substantial debt relief in the context of the Paris Club, quote end. There are no figures, no numbers, and when we asked the government spokesman earlier today, he said this all has to be worked out in a second deal among the member countries of the Paris Club. The Paris Club is mainly a club of rich Western or Northern industrial countries, embracing all Western European countries, certainly the U.S., Canada, and Japan. And to the members of this club, Iraq is owing between 30 to 40 billion U.S. dollars accumulated over the past 30 years, which is only a smaller portion of the overall international debt. The overall international debt Iraq accumulated is $120 billion. So even if there would be some measures of debt relief within the members club of the Paris Club, this might not mean very much for the reality in Iraq. Germany, out of these 30 to 40 billion U.S. dollars owed to members of the club, Germany has 4.4 billion. And France, 3 billion, Russia, 8 billion, Italy, 6 billion, It's only 1.7 billion. So this is the ranking order, and I don't know the figure for Great Britain. So it remains to be open how much money actually should be in this debt relief package and when it actually will happen. Certainly not before sometimes in the middle of next year. The minimum political condition, at least as far as the Germans are concerned, is that at least this provisional government must be in place, which is being foreseen in the latest schedule Bremer worked out for the transition of power, which would be after June 30th next year.
Interestingly, at the White House, spokesperson Scott McClellan was noncommittal when a reporter asked whether the United States would forgive the Iraqi debt, as James Baker goes around asking other countries to. McClellan said, that process is just beginning. We're looking at restructuring and reducing the debt. He said, we will keep you posted as this moves forward. It's not an issue that's raised by the U.S. press.
Well, I hope it will be more and more, because even conservative voices in the German political arena, members of the Christian Democratic Opposition, who more or less 100% backed the war against Iraq, now come out rather critical vis-à-vis the Bush administration. We have a prominent member of the Christian Democratic Party this morning saying, I don't accept that now the reconstruction of Iraq should be paid out of debt relief. There are enough oil revenues there. And before the Bush administration started the war, they have always declared that the reconstruction after the war could be financed totally with Iraqi oil revenues, quote end of this Christian Democratic member of German parliament. And there are others, again, all politicians who have backed the war against Iraq, who now don't accept that the U.S. is trying to finance a reconstruction, at least partially, out of debt relief.
Can you talk about James Baker himself? I mean, just in introducing you, talking about who he is at Baker Botts, which is the law firm he is a part of in Texas, which actually represents Saudi Arabia against a lawsuit filed by 911 families. Saudi Arabia, there is serious Iraq debt there that hasn't been a part of the discussion.
Well, I heard all that, Amy, and let me add some other elements to it which go a little further back but also have to do with the Middle East. Number one, if you remember, the immediate pretext to Iraq's invasion in Kuwait on August 2nd, 1990, there we had this famous or infamous meeting between the then U.S. ambassador to Baghdad, April Gillespie, with Saddam Hussein on the 25th of July 1990, at which they discussed the whole issue, the dispute Iraq had with Kuwait at the time concerning the border and oil fields under this border in the desert sand. And Gillespie and Saddam Hussein asked Gillespie what the U.S. government's opinion on all that would be, meaning the Bush senior presidency at the time, where Baker was the Secretary of State. And Gillespie said, well, this is not of our national interest. We know that because the records of the meeting are there, both the U.S. records and the Iraqi, and they are identical to the point. And many observers at the time, when this emerged, made the observation that maybe Saddam Hussein took this answer by Gillespie as a somewhat green light to invade Kuwait, which would certainly not excuse this illegal war he fought against Kuwait. But still, it would be, I think, politically very remarkable fact. When this all came out after the second Gulf War in March 1991, Baker and his staff first tried to blame Gillespie and said she messed it all up, it was her fault. And soon after that, a telex emerged from Baker to Gillespie, which proved that Baker instructed her to say exactly what she did say to Hussein at this meeting. Unfortunately, we still probably don't have the whole truth. Gillespie is dead by now, as you know. So Baker was a very instrumental player at the time. I also remember that he was, after the second Gulf War, the one who probably put the most pressure on the Israeli government at the time to come to some kind of talks, at least with the Palestinian side, which then led to the Madrid Conference So, yes, I do think he is, beyond what you already mentioned, still a very, and has been a very influential figure in U.S. Foreign policy, especially in this Middle East region mm-hmm. and vis-a-vis Iraq.
It's very interesting how well James Baker is served by this position, because he can maintain his other jobs, a senior advisor at the Carlyle Group, where really what he brings, or what George Bush Sr. brought to that company, was their ability to go to meet with foreign leaders, which opens access. And now he's doing it on taxpayer dollars. But in addition, that he does not have to leave his jobs. When Henry Kissinger was appointed to the 911 Commission, the pressure was that he should have to release his client list. Well, they have worked it out that Baker will only work a certain number of days a year, which means he does not have to give up, well, you could say his day job, either at Carlyle or at Baker Botts, which also represents Halliburton.
Yes, I heard that. Let me just remind the listeners about two other, well, anecdotes from 12 years ago, which I think still are somewhat important. The one is, after the Iraqi invasion in Kuwait, the UN Secretary, the UN Security Council, 2 days later, voted on the most comprehensive economic sanctions that had ever been handed down during the whole history of the United Nations, or even the League of Nations in the last century. And the problem was that the UN at the time did not have any instruments to control and to monitor whether or not these economic sanctions were successful, whether they might at some point force Saddam Hussein to withdraw his occupation forces from Kuwait. The only ones who had the means to control this were the US government at the time. This hasn't changed. They were the only ones who had the satellite systems in place, controlling whatever was moving on the ground there. They had, at this time at least, enough spies on the ground. But they wouldn't share any of the information with neither the UN or with anybody else. And it was Bush and Baker especially who, starting mid-September, less than 6 weeks after the Iraqi invasion and the vote on the sanctions in the Security Council, they started to argue that the sanctions were a total failure and that therefore one needed to take military action against Iraq. And the military buildup of U.S. forces actually started by the second half of September. And nobody was at this time in a position to contradict this claim that the economic sanctions were a failure. Later then, after the war was over in March 91, it emerged that the CIA had done an analysis which was given to Bush and Baker in mid-December, 4.5 months after the Iraqi invasion. And according to this analysis, the economic sanctions against Iraq were the most successful economic sanctions ever in the whole history of the last century. It brought down the Iraqi exports by 97%, the imports by 90%, and what is most important, the gross national product by 45%, and this in the short period of 4.5 months. And Baker and Bush decided to keep this CIA analysis secret, probably because the analysis ended with a recommendation by the CIA: if we continue these kind of sanctions for another 2 or 3 months, Saddam Hussein will have to withdraw his troops from Kuwait because he won't be able to sustain them, to feed them anymore. I make every bet, if this CIA analysis would have been known to the U.S. Congress when the Congress voted on January 12, 1991, to give the war power to the president, the Congress would have voted against it. You might remember it was not a very big majority. I think it was 52-47 in the Senate only. This is the one, and the other one is there was a meeting of the last chance, which was a meeting between Baker and then Foreign Minister Tariq Aziz here in Geneva on January 9th, 1991. Everybody expected it to last maybe half an hour, maybe an hour. Then it lasted 6, 7, 8, finally 11 hours. And worldwide, the hope was growing that they found some kind of political solution. And then at the evening when Baker gave his press conference, with his first sentence, it became clear, no, it was a failure. He never answered the question why his meeting with Tariq Aziz failed. We still don't know at which point this meeting failed, who got up first from the table and ended the negotiations. I hope at some point he might be forced to answer this question.
Andre Sumac, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Andre Sumac is the Geneva-based correspondent for the German newspaper Die Tage Zeitung, speaking to us from Geneva. You are listening to Democracy Now! Back in a minute.
It all began when they took me from my home and put me on death row, a crime for which I'm totally innocent, you know. I began to warm and chill to objects and their fields, a ragged cup, a twisted mop, the face of Jesus in my soup, those sinister dinner deals, the meal trolley's wicked wheels, a hook bone rising from my food, and all things either good or ungood. And the mercy seat is waiting, and I think my head is burning, and in a way I'm yearning to be done with all this weighing of the truth. An eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, and anyway I told the truth, and I'm not afraid to die. I hear stories from the chamber. Christ was born into a manger, and like some ragged stranger, he died upon the cross. Might I say it seems so fitting, in its way he was a carpenter by trade, or at least that's what I'm told.
You are listening to Democracy Now! The Mercy Seat by the late Johnny Cash here on Democracy Now! In just a minute, Aaron Patterson, who was on death row for 17 years, will join us. He's now running for the Illinois State House. He was pardoned by the Illinois governor earlier this year. And this news is coming out of Florida. U.S. Senator Bill Nelson said Monday the Bush administration last year told him and other senators that Iraq not only had weapons of mass destruction, but they had the means to deliver them to East Coast cities. Nelson, who is a Democrat from Tallahassee, said about 75 senators got that news during a classified briefing last October's congressional vote authorizing the use of force to remove Saddam Hussein from power. Nelson voted in favor of using military force. Nelson said he couldn't reveal who in the administration gave the briefing. The White House directed questions about the matter to the Pentagon. Defense officials had no comment. Nelson said the senators were told Iraq had both biological and chemical weapons, notably anthrax, and it could deliver them to cities along the eastern seaboard via unmanned aerial vehicles commonly known as drones. We're going to turn now to Alan Friedman, global economics correspondent to the International Herald Tribune and author of the book Spider's Web, The Secret History of How the White House Illegally Armed Iraq. We played this interview last November where he talked about the U.S. arming Iraq. We thought it would be instructive to look at again. This is Alan Friedman.
We need to go back to the beginning of the 1980s to understand how the United States created the monster that Saddam Hussein is today. In the early 1980s, remember, the United States was violently against the Islamic fundamentalists of Iran, of Ayatollah Khomeini. At the time, the United States, using the power of the White House, with particular interest by Vice President George Herbert Walker Bush, using the intelligence services and the Pentagon, embarked upon a tilt to Iraq. Nobody really liked Saddam Hussein. Everybody knew that he was a dictator who had gassed his own people. But the United States made the decision to back Iraq in order to use Saddam Hussein as a, you know, cynical balance of power against Iran. The tragic result, of course, was that as the United States armed Iraq in the early 1980s, a war continued throughout the 1980s between Iran and Iraq that cost the lives of more than 1 million people. What really happened then is as the 1980s progressed and as George Herbert Walker Bush moved from the vice presidency in the Reagan administration to the White House himself, the war in Iraq, war between Iraq and Iran ended, and of course what had been created was a kind of autopilot, if you will. My book and my research and the work that I did at the time with people like Ted Koppel of ABC Nightline, where we did a joint investigation and the work that was done at the time by William Safire in the New York Times and my own work in breaking the Iraqgate scandal showed essentially how the netherworld, the demimonde, the sort of dark world of intelligence agents, arms dealers, crooked financiers that had been used in the 1980s to get military equipment from the United States and Europe to Saddam Hussein when it was considered a good thing to do because he was being used as a bulwark against Iran, continued to function after the Iran-Iraq war ended. So essentially, a machinery of global dimension was put in place. Now, I discovered this at the end of the 1980s when I was reporting for the Financial Times of London, and we uncovered the scandal of more than $5 billion of American taxpayer-backed credits that had been funneled by the Atlanta, Georgia branch of an Italian bank to Saddam Hussein with the full knowledge of the CIA and later on of the White House under the Bush administration. That's because that bank, it later transpired, an Italian bank called BNL, its Atlanta, Georgia branch was being used to surreptitiously finance Saddam Hussein's purchase of both agricultural goods and weaponry. And the very frightening part of it is that this group of intelligence agents outside the government, but working with the blessing of the government, as it later turned out, with the blessing of people like James Baker and George Herbert Walker Bush, this organization of arms dealers and transshipment specialists continued to sell a whole variety of equipment to Saddam Hussein, including U.S. military Rockeye cluster bombs that were transshipped from Pennsylvania through Chile to Iraq, nuclear and chemical weapons technology, and missile technology. And the United States didn't really do anything to stop this shipment, because at the time, the argument used by the CIA and the White House was that if you allowed a limited amount of military weapons and technology to flow to Iraq, even though it was completely illegal against U.S. law, against international treaties, if you allowed this to happen as an intelligence operation, the rationalization in the Bush administration went, then you could keep better track of what kind of weaponry Saddam was developing. What really happened, of course, is that there were people along the way who were greedy, who were making money off it, and there were people in governments in Italy and Britain, in the Thatcher government and in the Andreotti government in Italy, who were working with their American counterparts, and they continued the flow of equipment. Some of this is very sophisticated stuff. And one of the way the scandal developed was I first uncovered documents, financial documents, for a British company called Matrix Churchill, based in Coventry in England, that was sending what seemed to be innocent machine tool equipment to Saddam Hussein. But it wasn't. It was dual-use technology that the CIA and the British intelligence knew was going into Saddam's missile program and his nuclear program, but they allowed it to happen. So the real problem is that we had a Frankenstein monster that got out of control, a Bush administration between 1988 and Operation Desert Storm in 1990-91 that essentially turned a blind eye to this continuing shipment to Iraq. And then, of course, when we had the invasion of Kuwait and the United States under Colin Powell and Schwarzkopf went in, and then President Bush decided not to finish the job but to leave Saddam alone, unfortunately, then it became time to cover up the tilt to Iraq, to cover up the way the United States had helped to shape and build Iraq's military strength. And there ensued a traditional cover-up, which nobody cared about when I brought it out with Ted Koppel in 1991, 92, and with the book Spider's Web 93, because people in America thought it was more interesting to look at Whitewater.
Alan Friedman speaking to us by video phone from Rome last November. Alan Friedman, global economics correspondent for the International Herald Tribune. His book is Spider's Web, The Secret History of How the White House Illegally Armed Iraq. You can go to our website at democracynow.org to hear the full hour interview. You can either listen to it audio streaming or watch it video streaming at democracynow.org. Well, a man who spent 17 years on death row for a crime he did not commit is running for the Illinois State House. Aaron Patterson was one of four men pardoned this past January as part of Illinois Governor George Ryan's clearing of death row in his final days in office. Patterson was convicted of killing an elderly Chicago couple in 1986. He spent 17 years on death row in a 6-by-9-foot cell. Despite repeated claims of innocence and accusations that police tortured him to confess to the murder, he's now 39 years old. This past January, then-Governor of Illinois George Ryan dealt the sharpest blow to the death penalty in three decades by granting clemency to 167 prisoners on death row. George Ryan was a conservative Republican governor, formerly an enthusiastic advocate of execution. He called the state's judicial system, quote, broken, arbitrary, and capricious, and racist. The blanket commutation followed an examination of the state's capital punishment system that determined 13 prisoners on death row were innocent. Aaron Patterson was one of four death row prisoners whom Ryan pardoned. And he joins us in our studio today. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Aaron Patterson.
Thank you for having me here today.
Well, when did George Ryan pardon you? What was the date?
I was pardoned January 10th, 2003.
When did you hear that George, when were you released from prison?
Well, I officially heard that I was going to be released at the same time everybody heard the speech that Governor George Ryan gave that same day.
The same day?
The same thing.
You were free?
Yeah, it was like 5 seconds after he mentioned my name about receiving a pardon. The phones rang in the security cages, and they told the captain and the warden to free me, to open my door and let me out.
What was it like?
Bittersweet to a certain extent, because they didn't mention certain other individuals' names who were on death row who were also innocent. Men such as Ronald Kleiner, Cortez Brown, Ronald Kitchen. These individuals, I felt, were innocent, and the evidence was there, but the governor didn't mention their names. So it was a blessing for me to get out, but I also felt that I was disheartened in the fact that they weren't released also.
Now, they were taken off of death row.
Well, I mean, officially they were taken off death row and given natural life without parole, which we consider the death penalty and installment plan. And that was something a lot of them didn't want. And it takes less pressure off the system when you give a person natural life instead of facing death. Your case loses that notoriety to it.
You are now running for the Illinois State House for a seat.
Yes.
And are you being challenged in terms of can you run? What are the laws for people who've been in prison? And you're in an unusual circumstance on death row for 17 years and now totally exonerated.
Right. Well, it might be a problem with the 2-year residency requirement, which I have no control over since I was being held hostage on death row for 17 years. There's no way that I can claim my residency in that area, the 6th District, and I would hope that my opponents would not use that against me because it would be very shameful and grimy of them to do so.
Yeah, I just saw an article to that effect that they were saying you are not living in the district,
right.
That when you are in prison, they count where the prison is, not where you actually live.
Right. Well, I mean, if that's the case, you know, if they want to be technical, maybe I should just submit my nomination on my petitions to Pontiac, Illinois, or probably Menard, Illinois, and say, well, this was my residency for the last 2 years in one of these death row locations, if they want to be technical. But I think the Board of Election has enough sense and integrity to know that I should be allowed to run, and that should be that issue should be weighed as far as the 2-year residency. I've been over there for at least 6 months, and it was through no fault of my own that I was being held hostage on death row.
If you were to win, what do you hope to accomplish in the Illinois State House?
I plan on starting a revolution down in the Illinois legislature, point blank revolution. I want to let liberal-minded politicians know it's safe to vote on controversial issues. It's safe to speak out against these issues and to free more innocent persons that are being held hostage in prison or on death row. The issues that I would use as my main platform would be the land grab that's going on in the city, where they're pushing blacks out the community to take those properties and use them for, like, strip malls. Another thing I want to go after is jobs for the individuals in the community. They say it's a major gang problem going on around the Inglewood area. Crime is rampant along with drug use and drug sales. I'm saying if they get these individuals jobs and vocational training, then there would not be any problems with the gang violence that goes on now. I also would like police accountability as well as prosecutor accountability. If these prosecuting police commit perjury or fabricate evidence or hide evidence or destroy evidence, then they should be fired and they also should go to jail.
Let's talk about your own case. The man in charge of Area 2's violent crime unit, where you were taken, was Lieutenant John Berg.
Yes.
He was fired in 1993 or retired? Unclear.
You could say he was both fired and retired because he still received his benefits, pension, and he's currently has a contract with the city of Chicago with our current mayor, Richard M. Daley. Well, he has a security firm contract with the city, and it seems to be some kind of relationships still between these two individuals.
Well, he left after investigators determined he'd used excessive force to squeeze a confession from a suspect.
Right. Andrew Wilson.
Among his critics, they say he has wired suspects to a device called a Tucker telephone, cranked electric shocks into them. They allege he and other police beat suspects, subjected them to mock Russian roulette, and chained them to hot radiators.
Yes.
Did any of this happen to you?
Yes, yeah, some or all those things happened to me. He also put plastic bags over individuals' faces to suffocate them until they passed out. He used baseball bats to beat suspects with telephone books to hit them up top. On top of the head, the electrical prod as well as the electrical crank system that he used, he would attach those to your genital parts, ears, feet, everything. He just was medieval about his way of torturing individuals in these police states. And some of all the 66 men and women that were tortured can bear witness to these facts. The Office of Professional Standard, who is a police entity that investigates police misconduct, has also agreed that this man, as well as his detectives, committed these type of acts.
Well, Aaron Patterson, this is part one of our two-part interview. Aaron Patterson will be back with us tomorrow, along with my co-host Juan Gonzalez of the New York Daily News, and we'll talk further about your 17 years in prison and then what you've done since you've been out and what you tell students around the country when you're called in to talk to them about death row and the criminal justice system. Aaron Patterson, just freed from death row in Illinois. And you are listening to Democracy Now! If you'd like to get a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-881-2359. That's 1-800-881-2359. By the way, we are looking for help in painting our offices. The painting party begins Thursday, tomorrow morning at 10. If anyone can help, please email us at mail, M-A-I-L, at democracynow.org. We're in Chinatown in New York. Or just give us a call at 212-431-9090. That's 212-431-9090. We'd love that gift in this holiday season. We have a lot of painting to do. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, Anna Nagar, Elizabeth Press, Jeremy Scahill, Purvey Sharma, Mike DeFilippo, Rich Kim, our engineers. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.